Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guest this morning grew up in Ireland and, like many of their generation, took their chances by emigrating to the United States in the 1980s. But unlike many of that generation, Ciarán Staunton and his wife Orla chose to stay on and settle in America. And their children, Rory and Kathleen, were born there in 1999 and 2001. They're in the pub business and their bars include O'Neill's Bar in Manhattan. Ciarán is now president of the Irish Lobby for Immigration Reform, an organisation he helped to found. He was also amongst the Irish Americans prominently involved in engaging the United States with the peace process. More recently, both Orla and Ciarán have campaigned to raise public awareness of sepsis and medical misdiagnoses after the truly tragic and untimely death of their 12-year-old son, Rory, last year. You're both very welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Welcome
for having
home,
us,
as they say.
Thank you.
Start off first. Where did you both meet? Did you meet here or did you meet in the States?
Orla's brother Neil had a number of publications.
Neil O'Dowd.
Neil O'Dowd, yes. And he had Irish American Magazine, which was a great magazine, launched first, followed up by the Irish Voice. He needed someone to launch it and get it off the ground in Boston. I was living there at the time and asked me if I would help him out, because a number of people didn't want to, as was already an existing, more conservative, old-fashioned Irish echo there. So I said, sure, a challenge. So eventually I got to meet his sister.
And is it true your mother, Orla, met Ciarán before you did?
Yes, she did. She had come over for the launch of the Irish Voice and had come home and said how she'd met this really nice guy from Boston who was very interesting and very
funny. Did you believe her?
I didn't even know who he was at the time. It was only several months into being with Ciarán I realised, oh, shoot, that's who she was talking about. So, yeah.
Lots of people of our generation went away in the 1980s to places like the States. Yes. Why did you go, Orla?
Well, I had gone to America to visit Neil and loved it. So when I came back, my mum said, I got off the plane and said, I'm going back, that's it. So I went and got my leave of absence and took off over to America. And when I was there, I got the Donnelly visa and decided to stay.
Why did you love America?
I loved it because, truthfully, it just made me feel alive. I remember just walking down Fifth Avenue and feeling, oh, my God, I'm alive. And it just seemed to have endless possibilities.
And Ciarán, given your father's love of America and relationship with it, it was almost destiny you'd end up there.
It was. I had grown up listening about America. He lived there during the Depression. He still described petrol as gas and called pennies cents. And we knew all about Philadelphia and Chicago, as you pronounce it, with the strong R way back then.
First of all, what part of Mayo are you from? And secondly, tell me about how your dad ended up going there.
Was born in an area called Tullabone, which is near Lewisburg in County Mayo.
Beautiful part.
Beautiful part. My dad was one of 14. And his dad, we have a letter that his dad sent to cousins in the States in 1922 saying, I have 8 daughters and 6 sons. There's nothing here for them. If you could send the fare home for one, the oldest daughter, she will send the fare home in turn for the others. And I believe 7 of them went between 1923 and 1929. But he came back in the 1930s to look after his dad, who was ill and never got around to going back.
In your case, Orla, you're from Drogheda, aren't you?
Drogheda, yeah.
And your dad, he never really travelled, but he was incredibly interested in everybody else's travels in the rest of the world.
He was. He travelled as far as London, but when my brothers and sisters, when they were travelling, if they wrote home, which they did pretty often, he didn't just want to hear I'm doing fine. He wanted to know what it was like, where they were living. He wanted a full detail of the temperatures, of this, the crops, everything. And, you know, my mom also was very interested in travel and encouraged us to see a little bit of the world before we decided to settle down.
Tell me about the family you grew up in again. I know your brothers are Neil and Fergus O'Dowd.
There's 7 of us. There's Trina, my oldest sister, Fergus. There's Donal, and there's Neil, Micheál, and myself.
You're the baby.
I'm the baby. It was a very noisy house, very noisy house. And you were always desperate to find that little place on your own where you could sit and read without somebody interrupting you. But we very much were the family that sat around the table and talked about politics and life and countries and everything. It was that kind of a house. It was it was full of fun, but full of interesting topics of conversation and stuff.
When you first went to America, Ciarán, you had an aunt, didn't you, who gave you sound advice from the early days?
I think you'll often hear stories now, especially there's another generation going. And before that, there was the 80s generation that I was probably head of. And before that, you had the 50s and the 20s. Yeah. And the crew that went in the 20s and 30s went with one-way tickets, literally. But they had come through tough times. They'd come through War of Independence. In our own family, they survived the Civil War. Yeah. So many of them had looked death in the eye and they'd moved on from that. They went to the States. So they then knew they were one way. And they adopted the American ways, but never put their heads down. Mm-hmm. They always held their heads high. So wherever they wanted to go for, they went for. And I remember my aunt saying when I arrived there that some of the first thing they did was make sure you get a good address, because to get a good job, you need a good address. And she was one of those people that was very, very positive. When she would arrive once every 2 years in Lewisburg, everyone would want to say, well, how is such one doing and everyone doing? And everyone, according to her, was doing great. She would never come back with someone.
This bad story. Yes. I love her.
And when she went back from here to meet the cousins back in America, she would be boasting about the fine fields of hay in their fields and the fine cattle and how well everything was doing. So she had almost, and instilled that, is that is something that said is, listen, there's only one comment to make about someone. That's a good one. Yeah. And it costs you nothing.
Yeah,
and that was it. And when she was in her 80s when I arrived there. But there was one very good point she made. It was what, when the young people were coming in the 80s, and I was in ahead of them when we were trying to legalise them, and there was some crowd who'd come probably in the 50s. They're saying, oh, that crowd that are coming now and they're out all night drinking and they're very wild. And she stood up and she said, listen, all night drinking is nothing new. We did it in the 20s. And there was plenty of arrests and there was plenty of fights. Ye did it in the 50s. And the crowd that are coming now are doing it. But they're no worse than any of us. They're having a good time. We should support them.
You both did get very involved in the immigration, didn't you, in terms of trying to get visas.
Yes.
Tell me about that, Orla.
It became apparent that something had to be done. There were thousands and thousands of Irish people over there out of status. It became crucial to try and legalise them in some form. And Ciarán in particular, I think, was part of the initial crusade to try and get visas.
We started off, I think, because when I got there in 82, there was about half a dozen undocumented. It would be probably 84, 85. So no one really knew what to do.
Yeah.
And then, and again, and I think this is a plug where I know others have mentioned this, is where the GAA was the body on the ground in North America, as they're all over the place. Yeah. And they were trying to work with some people, and it turned out the Congressman Donnelly was the local guy. And he did get some Donnelly visas. There was not a lot of information with the undocumented at the time. A lot of people were afraid that if you applied, that this was a little way of getting immigration officials your figures. And as Brian Donnelly said quite angrily afterwards, more Donnelly visas ended up on mantelpieces in Ireland than in the United States.
I think the Irish Voice as well, because that had come into existence at the time. I think that made a huge difference, because the young people were reading that newspaper and they were trusting what was being read in it. And I think that really spurned
that
on
did.
The whole immigration movement also.
And we put the unfortunate thing with the Donnelly visas and the amnesty programme of 1986, it only covered anyone that was there up to 82 under amnesty. Donnelly, most people missed. So we then had to go back to the drawing board and say, listen, most people have missed it. So we managed to get a hold of, we set up an organisation called the Irish IIRM, myself and quite a few others, and we travelled from city to city. And out of that, we got Bruce Morrison.
Yeah.
And we got 70,000 Morrison visas. Then we got Schumer visas. The one mistake we've made continuously, Miriam, is that we have not got a long-term visas.
Because it's still a problem.
Yeah.
It always
will be. It's the next parish over. Yeah. And one thing, and I know in the last couple of years, there was quite sceptics when people were saying, there's loads of jobs in Ireland, we'll never need immigration visas again, forget about it. A lot of people came home to the Tiger only to lose everything they brought home with them. Many of them are back again in the States.
The new wave of people going over now, what have you observed about them? Are they similar to when you went over? Are they different?
I think they're very similar.
I suppose I would have to echo what my aunt said.
Yes.
I have yet to see immigrants from Ireland coming to the States with their hands out for anything.
Right.
They come over with their sleeves rolled up, ready to go to work. Yeah. And they will come into us in the bar business saying, where can we get jobs? They're not coming in to say, where can we get rent allowance? Because there isn't anything. Or where can we get dole? There isn't any. Yeah. Coming to the States, you know you have to roll up your sleeves. There's no pessimist ever crossed the Atlantic. Or if he or she did, they turned around and came back the next day. So what we're getting today are no different to what came into us in 85, 86 when I was in the bar business, or probably earlier years. Most people are saying, OK, we're coming here. Many of them are paying off mortgages and paying off cars and paying off loans. But everyone, again, would like to be doing it legally.
Did many of the people you went away with, say, in the 80s, have they come back? I mean, you've chosen to stay. You've made your lives there. Did many come back?
Many of my friends came back, and I think they're very happy here. Some stayed and, like me, built a life over there and were happy also. But many did leave. I think they left once they found a partner from Ireland and wanted to have children and figured out that they'd have a nice life here.
At what stage did you both decide you would stay, that this was the life you were going to live in America?
Well, we opened the business. We got married in 96. We opened O'Neill's in 97. We were still talking about it. And people often say, oh, we want to get the children home before they go to school. And there's this thing. And it's mainly a professional opinion by people who have never had their children in schools in the US, right? Saying, oh, we want to get them home before they go to school. So we hadn't made up our minds still, and Rory started school, and we liked the school he was in, and we liked what was happening.
I think a lot of it had to do with where we settled. Also, we settled in a really fantastic community in Sunnyside Gardens, where we met a lot of people, not just Irish, people from all over America. And, talking to them, listening to them, it took any fear factor away from me, certainly, in terms of what type of a life my child would have if we brought them up in America.
So it's your home, which brings us to our first piece of music, which is the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
The Battle Hymn of the Republic, there was one thing we didn't speak about much earlier, is that one thing we grew up in our house was a sense of justice. And whether it be in North America in the Civil War, where this goes back to, or the civil rights, or in Ireland, or whether it be Selma or Montgomery or Burntollet or Free Derry, you name it. There was one thing we always grew up with was justice in our house.
I think Rory and Kathleen picked up that whole sense of justice.
OK, let's listen now to the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Battle Hymn of the Republic. Wow, when you listen to it like that, it's such a beautiful piece, isn't it?
Fabulous.
Do you feel American or Irish? Or Irish-American? I was just thinking, coming out of that.
How much time do you have left on your show?
hours, Ciarán.
Hours. We've always, I'd say, said that you don't have to bury one culture to promote another.
We're very proud of both cultures, and I enjoy America, but I love being from Ireland, and I think it's I think they go hand in hand for us. Yeah, definitely.
And for Kathleen, your daughter now, who's 11, because she'll be totally American in one way.
Well, it's funny because she asked me yesterday. She said, "Am I American or am I Irish?"
Good question.
Yeah, and I said, "Well, Kathleen,
ask your father."
he'll straighten you on that one.
I said, "You were born in America, but your parents are 100% Irish. So that's how you have to look at yourself." Because she loves Ireland, and she loves America. So of course, she's a little confused. So she accepted that. She said, OK, that's good by me. So
she's got the richness of both, which
she
is
has,
wonderful.
Exactly, yeah.
Last night, for my research for this programme, I was reading Conor O'Clery's book, The Greening of America, and I covered the peace process, but I never knew how important you were in getting Irish America on board and that support.
Well,
you're a dark horse.
Very dark horse.
Dark horse, yes. And I could do one or two things. I could deny all knowledge of what the great Conor O'Clery. If there was anyone else, I could try and badmouth him and say he made it up. I could also say that success is many fathers, failure is an orphan. And as you'll know, as someone who covered it at the time, the people who were badmouthing John Hume and badmouthing Albert Reynolds, who I have enormous admiration for, those are all the people now who are. We were in the peace process, and sometimes you feel like saying, really? I don't remember you.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Orla and I have, well, we've chosen is we are not involved in partisan politics. So that means we can equally praise or kick whoever the person is. But Albert Reynolds that time was probably one of the most underestimated people of this, who with Gerry Adams and John Hume and people then like Neil O'Dowd, Bill, bringing in Bill Flynn, Bruce Morrison and Chuck Feeney and people like that.
He's avoided his. Oh,
yeah, I was just about to say that he'd be a very good politician. Now, Kieran Staunton, go back to you, right?
Yes.
What I want to know is, how did you get involved? Because you were a very important link on the side of Sinn Féin almost, weren't you? And
yes,
how did you get
true.
Into that position?
Again, I have selective amnesia when it comes to most of it. However,
I think that if I was just butt in here, I think that to give you a compliment, Kieran, you're someone of...
Is this being taped?
Yes.
He is someone of integrity, and I think that different sides knew that he could be trusted. I think that was a key.
But how come you were so close to Sinn Féin that they trusted you? Because at the time, they trusted few but their own.
This is true, I suppose. I think.
extracting teeth here.
Let me just go back a couple of. Let's go back a couple of steps, if you want.
We'll be here for the next 5 hours. In other words, you helped when that key moment when Gerry Adams got his visa.
Yes.
That was a key moment. Everyone agrees.
Yes,
the historians agree with that. You were key to him getting that visa. Now, so how did you know Gerry?
Yeah. I've known Gerry many years, right? We've both known him many years. He and Claire were at our wedding. And I think what was happening here was that the focus was on, well, there's just one side of this problem. And if we could only sort this, get rid of the bad guys, everything would be fine. Whereas the time had come to focus. Instead of going out and saying to people, well, unless you support the Republican movement 100%, you don't have a role to play. And changing that role to say, if you support a united Ireland, if you're opposed to what's going on at the moment, you have a role to play. But what is that role? And I think people like Neil and Bill Flynn and many others said the role could be a US involvement, third party coming into it. Because at the time, the Irish government leading up to Albert Reynolds really, Charlie Haughey got involved a small bit, but weren't really honest brokers. They were kind of, it was a containment.
How did you meet Gerry in the first place?
I believe I met him many years ago on a human rights. We were doing a human rights group back from America. And I had been involved in the issues of prisoners.
So basically, Gerry Adams trusted you. And I'm reading Conor O'Clery's book. There was that key meeting, wasn't there? Which turned out to be funny in the end, in the pizza parlour or whatever, with Bill Flynn, which helped get the visa, wasn't it? Tell me about that meeting.
Was, well, what happened was, and Neil O'Dowd was one of the people that came up with that, and it was sometime earlier, a group of Irish Americans, and I had an Irish American night. Now, there is some spin at the moment. There's no such thing as an Irish American vote and all this kind of nonsense, and you've read it. But Neil and quite a few of the others came up with the idea that they would get an Irish American candidates night. You'd invite the presidential candidates and say, well, what are you going to do about the North? And the whole idea was to send in someone from the middle, someone who would actually act as an honest broker. And Bill Clinton had said a number of things that night. Well, one of the questions was, would you give Gerry Adams a visa? He was an elected official from West Belfast. He was an MP, and he suggests I would. And the whole idea was to ask him for a visa, but to create something important enough, not just to come up for an Irish-American dinner. And Bill Flynn at the time ran a very prestigious organisation. Henry Kissinger was on the board 3 years earlier that honoured Margaret Thatcher. So it wasn't any just group. And the idea being, well, we'll invite him. This is prestigious. And let's see what happens. And that became the rallying cry. And it turned down. They just wanted to give for 24 hours.
But the visa.
The visa. Mm. But this went up every hour. It was up, it was down, their phone calls were going back and forth, no one knew what was going to happen. And then the last thing was, well, we can't have them turn around in 24 hours, so they gave them 48 hours. And in that 48 hours, we got them onto Nightline, we got them onto Larry King. And I think it was one thing that exposed the Brits somewhat. They were very angry because when Gerry Adams was on Larry King, people in America could hear Gerry Adams. But people in Britain watching Larry King could only hear an actor.
Dubbed voice,
and,
yeah.
And that was explained. So that started a long road down that many people would say, well, was it perfect? No, it wasn't. People are living today that wouldn't have.
There had often been criticism, Orla, you know, of Irish Americans, maybe pre the peace process in the States, that you were in some way, I suppose, too sympathetic to Republican violence, NORAID, groups like that, which I think tangentially you were involved in.
Yes, I was, yes.
And it's all history now.
Yes.
But do you think that's a fair criticism, that maybe it was too one-sided, that you didn't really understand what sometimes, I suppose, the effects of the Republican violence could be back home?
Well, I wasn't involved in NORAID, but for the record, but I think for me, leaving the country, and I can only speak for myself, looking back in, I think it opened my eyes to the injustices that were going on. I think, you know, living here, I wasn't as sure. But once I left and I looked back in and I was like, oh, no, that's not right. We're fighting for stuff all over the world and it's not right that this is going on in the north of Ireland. I did feel that it was a little over the top, some of the Irish Americans. It was often hard to get them to see the other side of the argument. And that would be my only criticism. But their hearts were absolutely in the right place.
Do you think, and this is the last question on this, but do you think maybe when you are in America, it's easier to detach yourself from the horror of what does happen when each side, I suppose, uses violence? And maybe that's why NORAID, because you were involved in NORAID.
And our role that time was for the family, was again human rights work. Our role was for the families of prisoners to make sure there's minibuses to bring them down to Port Leash or bring them wherever, some of them often going to England. Mm. And many of them families were wrongly convicted. I mean, now the truth is out, but that time where we to see something coming down the road is that oftentimes it took a United States congressman to get an issue moved. Oftentimes it took letters from a United States senator. I think it goes back to that. Are you happy sitting on your hands and doing nothing?
Well, you didn't do nothing, to be fair. Like, in the end, you were key to getting the visa.
Well, there's a lot of keys. So
well, you got... You helped him get that visa, which was crucial to the peace process at that time.
Yeah, I think that what happened was that people engaged in dialogue and that's what made a big difference. And I think that everybody accepted that, that if people can sit around a table and exchange their views, you've got them to the table. And that was key.
We're going to take a piece of music, Orla, now that you both like.
We both love the Coolin. We both grew up listening to the Coolin. We played it at our wedding and we also played it at the celebration in New York that we had for Rory. So it's a very special piece for us.
Coolin there, a piece of music you both love. And as you said, Orla, when you were introducing that piece of music, you had it played recently at a remembrance for your son, Rory. Tell me about Rory, will you? How old he was and what happened to him?
Rory was 12 years of age. He was a phenomenal kid. I don't just say that. Anyone who met him, he left a lasting impression on them. He was very involved in everything, in politics, in sports, in his school life. He set up a debate team in school and he was captain of the debate team. He was an amazing debater. He also led a campaign called Spread the Word to End the Word, which was retard, which is used by a lot of children to describe whatever, being stupid or whatever. So he set up a campaign in the school where the children had to sign a pledge that they wouldn't use the word. He had flown his own airplane. He used to spend many hours on Flight Simulator. Sully Sullenberger was his hero. And he pestered us for flight lessons, which we did not want to give him at 12 years of age. So we said, oh, no, you can't get them till you're 16. And he went online and, of course, came into the kitchen saying, I found a place that gives them at 12. So we tortured ourselves over it. And for his 12th birthday, we let him take a plane up. And he was just so happy. He was very kind, very, very kind. I found him very calm. He loved his little sister, Kathleen. He played basketball. He was a lot of fun. He had a great sense of justice and injustice. And he was just a very smart, very, very loving child.
And I've seen pictures of him. He's just an incredibly healthy looking boy as well, kind of. Very tall, wasn't he? Was he red hair?
I call it strawberry blonde.
Yeah, but
Americans
strawberry blonde.
Call it
beautiful
red.
Anyway.
Yeah, he was 5'9" and he was 165 pounds and he was very, very, very healthy.
Yeah,
you would pick him out as the big kid in the class or the big kid in the neighbourhood.
The healthy looking kid.
The healthy looking kid, yeah.
So then last year, what happened?
What happened is something we'll ever come to terms with, but... Rory was in school and he fell playing basketball. It was a Tuesday he fell. He cut his arm on that day, and then the following day he fell again. And that night, about midnight, I heard him throwing up in the bathroom, and I went in, and he wasn't throwing up a lot, but he was saying, Mom, it's my leg, it's my leg, it's my leg. So I brought him back to bed and I rubbed his leg and he went back to sleep. And then the following morning when he got up, he was running a temperature of 104, which he had never had. And I started giving him Tylenol to try and bring the temperature down, and nothing was hitting it. And he was still complaining about the pain in his leg. So we began calling our pediatrician, and finally she called us back, and we brought him in to see her. And by the time we were bringing him in to see her, he was leaning on me. He was so weak. And so we brought him in, and she did his vital signs. And, you know, both Rory and I said, you know, I know he vomited in the office, and we said, it's not the vomit, it's the pain in his leg. That's where the real pain is. And she said, oh, no, I know what this is. This is a stomach virus that's going around New York. I've seen it all before, and sent us off to get some fluids. And Kieran, you can...
I brought Rory in and they gave him the various checkups and took his blood test, took everything and gave him some fluids and released him, saying if he was thrown up to give him some medication. And that night he wasn't well. The next morning he wasn't well. His temperature was still 104, which was higher than it had ever been. We started calling the paediatrician again and she said, oh, I'm not worried about the temperature. You need to get foods into him. And it was late and you need to get water into him. So one said, you don't understand him. He's very sick. He cannot take this. So finally that evening, his skin started getting a dark blue, purple, black. And I called her. And this was 9 o'clock at night. So she got him into the hospital and she had called ahead. When we got there, they were waiting for him. And there was like an APB, whatever they call it, all buttons on red, and they went running and running when we arrived with him. And we had him in and they started, we had to cut off his clothes off him with the scissors, cut off the clothes. And I saw Orla talking to the doctor, and I sent him over and I was talking to him, and one doctor walked in and said, you know, how are you doing? And he was saying, whatever, he asked him what day of the week it was, and Orla said, well, why don't you ask him who's president? And he said, who's president? He said, Barack Obama. And then Orla said, and who'll be president for the next 4 years? And he said, Barack Obama. That was the last thing he said.
Yeah,
he went off to sleep.
Last,
we
yes.
put the oxygen on him then. And then Orla went over to talk to the doctor.
Everybody was trying to avoid my eyes. And finally I got this doctor to talk to me. And I said, well, how is he? And he said, he's not good. And I said, well, what do you mean he's not good? He was here last night. What do you mean he's not good? He said, he's seriously ill. And I said, well, how? And he said, he's gravely ill and we need to get him up to the ICU as fast as possible. And the ICU people came down. They were wonderful. I mean, they were very cheery. They were very nice to him. And he thanked them every time they took blood. And he just kept saying to me, "Mom, my toes are so cold. My toes are so cold." And they explained to him that there were a couple of things they needed to check out and they needed to put him to sleep. And they brought him upstairs to the ICU. And then when we got to the ICU, the medical team there were amazing. But you knew it was very serious. You knew it was very, very serious. There were so many doctors and nurses around him. And then they tried to... What they said was something's attacking his blood system and we need to find out what it is. And they had thought it was possibly meningitis. And they sent away the bloods, and then the following day it came back that that he was in toxic shock syndrome. But I thought that might be better, the meningitis, but it wasn't. They told me it wasn't good at all. You know, he was so tall. He was so strong looking. Mm-hmm. He was so healthy.
He was a big, strapping guy. Healthy. The photograph I showed you there, he was 5'9". He was 165 pounds, or in Irish times, 11.5 stone. He was a big, broad fella. And he was only just getting into growing, because we used to actually joke a bit. As I said, "I better stop beating you up now, because soon I won't be fit to." Right? And he was a smashing kid.
This beautiful boy of yours fell on Tuesday in school. Yeah. Is that what happened? His wound got infected?
Well, according to the medical examiner, there was no other point where she could see of entry. So the wound got infected.
So in the end, it was sepsis or septicemia, as we might know it as. Yeah. Is that what happened?
That's what happened. Basically, what sepsis is when it's your body reacting to a bacterial infection, but it overreacts. So what happened was that his body began... blocking the oxygen getting to other parts of his body, and that's why he began to change colour. So while we watched him in the hospital bed, he began to change colour all over, to sort of a dark blue, black colour, which was the blood wasn't getting to where it should have been. And they did everything in the ICU unit. They did everything. And each doctor in the ICU unit, when we saw the reports afterwards, said their first sentence was that he was sent home on a Thursday night from the hospital with no meds. And with sepsis, every hour counts. Every hour that it's not diagnosed, you lose 8% of your body. So every hour it's not diagnosed, you're dying.
But I'm just trying to understand how you possibly deal with this as a parent. So your son falls in the gym, happens all the time, and on Saturday you're with him in a hospital. And at what stage did you both realise he was not going to make it?
Well, that thought doesn't cross your mind.
No.
It's not your child. It's always someone else's child. We had everyone praying for him. Rory's beautiful, big blondie, fluffy kid. His body was legs are black, blue. Face gone black and blue.
I just couldn't believe it.
His arms was the size of a grown man's thighs at the stage. And they were working day and night, and we were in talking to him, and Father Tom came in, and we all talked to him, and Neil came in, and all his cousins were over there, came in, and we were all having conversations beside him. And on Sunday was Palm Sunday, we were down, everything going on, and they had said 48 hours. And I remember Fergus called me at, 2 or 3 o'clock on Sunday. And I said, "Well, Fergus, with the help of God, when you call tomorrow morning, everything will be fine. The 48 hours left clipped it." And I believed it. Well, I had to want to believe it. So at some time we went over and they were just changing up the rooms, we thought. And the next thing, the doctor came in and said, "Lads, guys, I have news for you. We have to put him on the kidney dialysis machine. It may kill him, but we have to put him on." He said, and then he said, which I'll never forget, "We've had to revive him twice already." And just as he was explaining something, the nurse came in and said, "Doctor, we need you fast." A couple of minutes, he came back in later, shaked his head, saying, "Sorry, we couldn't save him." That's when we knew. Not for 1 minute beforehand. Those are the words. "Sorry, we couldn't save him." That was at 6 o'clock Sunday evening. our beautiful boy died.
That's just so sad. I'm so sorry. How do you deal? I don't even know what to ask when somebody's...
There is no dealing.
There is nothing.
There is no dealing. There is no template, because it's one doctor friend of ours, Dr. Kevin Gale in New York, said it's unnatural for the old to bury the young. And there isn't even a word in the English language.
No.
Because when a child buries their parents, they become orphans. When a man or wife buries their partner, they become widows or widowers. There's no word for what we are.
I think it's torture.
Torture.
It's real torture. It's living every day knowing you're not going to see him is torture. And it's really one foot in front of the other. A lot of counselling, a lot of support from family who have been amazing, including all his cousins and aunts and uncles and our community that have been unbelievable in the States and people here. But it's still, you know, you wake up sometimes and you're like, really, am I going through this? And it was the shock of losing him so fast and to something that I had never heard of. I never thought there was anything that could take my child in 4 days other than, you know, be knocked down by a car or whatever. And it was the shock of the whole thing. It was just...
And yet sepsis kills more people in America than breast cancer, lung cancer and stroke combined. And we had never heard of it.
Yeah.
It's the third largest killer in the United States. And it is the largest killer of children in the world. And we never heard of it.
Yeah.
We never heard of it. Here you have a beautiful boy who had so much to live for.
And if I could say something too, that we know the cure for sepsis, it's antibiotics and fluids. It's as simple as that. If it's diagnosed when you walk into the hospital room or to your paediatrician, or if as a parent you suspect sepsis, which is why we're advocating now that parents not just suspect meningitis or a bite, but they suspect sepsis also.
Since we went talking about this, we know of 3 or 4 stories that people have sent to us whose children have been saved because they read of Rory's story. And when they were in the hospital, they asked them to do a sepsis test or check it for sepsis. And one woman wrote, thanks to your son, Rory, my 12-year-old, is now standing beside me at the swimming pool.
Oh, that's such a lovely story.
It's a lovely story, but what my daughter Kathleen said, well, it's a pity someone hadn't done that for Rory.
Yeah.
Would the medic say it's very difficult to diagnose? Is that fair or not?
Well, if you're not looking for it, it's difficult to diagnose because it could mask itself because you see vomiting, you see a high fever.
Yeah.
So you say, okay, this is a stomach virus. But to those who are looking for it, they will see it.
Does that make it more difficult to deal with your grief? In other words, do you go from grief to anger?
There is awful anger. I mean, there's anger because we were deprived of someone from his writings and from everything else who wanted to change the world for good. Mm-hmm. Life has been, the world has been deprived of him. We have been deprived of him. And some people go back to the various things like being hit by a car, what's called acts of God, whatever you want to put them. But this wasn't something, this was neither of those on one hand. And secondly, being brought to a different hospital or a different anything on the day, or the gym teacher washing out the wound, or the first doctor saying, well, I'm going to give him a shot of antibiotics to start the battle. The problem was that Big Rory fought this battle all on his own.
Well, the Commissioner for Health in New York State is leading the country in... he's looking for aggressive diagnosis of sepsis, which is a whole new area. And they compare it to heart attacks of the 1980s, that sepsis is at a level now that it has to be treated that way. And how the commissioner explained it to me was that if you walk into an emergency room right now with a pain in your chest, the unit will immediately come get you and they'll know what to do. So what New York is going to do is to pretty much set up sepsis units that will come in. And if a doctor thinks you may be in sepsis, then they'll come in with their fluids, with the antibiotics, and you'll be treated. When he was sent home from the hospital the first night, his symptoms, they took vital signs 12 minutes before he left, and all his vital signs had gone way up, and they never communicated a word to us. And that night, Rory had a, you know, what we thought he was sleeping off a fever, but actually he was getting worse and worse.
The impact of something like this that's so tragic, so completely catastrophic in your lives, what, as a couple, does it unite you? I mean, how do you both deal with it?
I don't know. This is...
I think we support each other. I mean, I have bad moments and Kieran will support me. He has bad moments, I'll support him. I think that's how it's done. And then you have to... We're together in seeking justice for Rory. So that takes up a lot.
And we have Kathleen time. And we have to keep her going. But it's... You don't see it coming. I mean, some days you're just walking down the road and it's like meeting a car on the wrong side of the road or being hit by a 2x4.
Do you pray? Do you have faith? Initially I
was certainly angry, but what I do feel very strongly now is that Rory is with a good God right now.
And in your own quiet moments, do you pray? Do you?
We have to believe. We do believe that Rory's out there. It's what keeps us going. It's what keeps Kathleen going. The reason we had him buried in Ireland was that we couldn't face the thought of him in a lonely grave in Queens.
Right. I think that, I am looking for a very strong spiritual connection. You know, and you try to find passages and books that mean something to you. And I think that's going to be a long road ahead.
It's hard to, it's very hard to concentrate. To concentrate, and as I say in computer terms, it's the hard drive.
Yeah,
now, Ola is better than I am. We'll sit down, we'll write a list of things to do.
Yeah.
If we can.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of sitting down and you coming and saying, I have three things to do next week, can you do them?
Mm-hmm.
You have to sit down on a piece of paper, write them out and match them up against what's going on next week.
I think it's like even getting on the airplane to come home the last time. We were on the airplane, we were actually bringing him home. So all those things are very, very difficult. So it's one situation after another.
It's one at a time. And it's like me going to Mayo the last time. After we buried him here, I drove to Mayo. I had to. But it was the first trip without him ever. Cruel. Because our trip to Mayo was a journey to Mayo. Mm-hmm. We'd stop in Longford since he was a toddler in this little shopping centre and we'd let them gallop around there for a while. And then we'd stop someplace else and gone through Bohola. We'd give a verse of three pubs in Bohola and talk about Paul O'Dwyer and all the guys. And he loved in Tullabawn Beach with his cousins and they're out in the sand and the helicopter. And even if it was Arctic water in Tullabawn Beach, they still went out because a couple of adults had to go out in it. And he with his cousin Donald would plan that trip to Tullabawn starting the previous November. Mm. Right? And they're the cousins from Dublin and we had the sandwiches and we had, and these are the things. And
the one thing I would say is that, you know, and I think we're both very, very, very agreeable on this, is that Rory would not want this to happen to anybody else. And I think that's what motivates us in many ways right now to get up in the morning to like the commissioner in New York has announced this legislation in memory of Rory. And we have a lot of work to do on sepsis because we want it to go to federal level. And we're also working on Rory's law. And that is essentially a parent-patient bill of rights in paediatric units in the hospital. It's about communication. It's mandated communication that the doctor has to identify themselves, the doctor has to communicate to you what they think the diagnosis is or any other possible diagnosis that they're thinking about, and that they have to tell you any blood tests that have been taken, and that they will provide you with a phone number as a backup. It's being operated on a pilot scheme at LIJ, Long Island Jewish Hospital in Queens. And we're very hopeful that law will pass also, because from our experience, paediatric emergency rooms are very scary places. They're scary for parents and they're scary for the kids. Mm. And 90% of the doctors are amazing, but there is that 10% that are not giving you what they should be giving you. So we feel you've got to mandate it.
But it's very giving of you both to try and help other children, despite your incredibly recent grief. We're going to finish on a piece of music, Pink.
Yeah. I chose this one. I was listening to the radio one day and this song came on, and literally I just fell to my knees because I think about him, Kieran thinks about him day and night, and the song is about meeting them again and what you might say or do if you did.
What's it called?
It's called Beam Me Up.
Orla, Kieran, thank you both so much. Everyone who's listening to this are just so sorry for what happened to your beautiful boy, Rory.
Thanks, Penny. As Orla said, we don't want to scare anyone, but what we have said, and if you're looking once for any regular sickness, but look twice for sepsis.
My thanks on Sound Good Day to Sheila Neveal, to my producer Eileen Heron. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, we go out listening to that beautiful song from Pink.
Thank you.
There's a whole nother conversation going on in a parallel universe where nothing breaks and nothing hurts. There's a waltz playing frozen in time, blades of grass on tiny bare feet. I look at you and you're looking at me. Could you beam me up?
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.